It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
It was a historic day at the Supreme Court. For the first time, the justices were considering whether former presidents have immunity from prosecution for acts they took while in office, a question they've never needed to answer before. Donald Trump claims he has absolute immunity and that special counsel Jack Smith can't try him for trying to overturn his 2020 election loss. During oral arguments, the liberal and conservative justices seemed to have different concerns. The conservatives, like Justice Samuel Alito, were concerned that presidents without immunity would be subjected to abusive prosecutions, while the liberals, like Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, were concerned that presidents with immunity would be emboldened to commit crimes while in office.
I mean, the presidents have to make a lot of tough decisions about enforcing the law, and they have to make decisions about questions that are unsettled, and they have to make decisions based on the information that's available. Do you really, did I understand you to say, well, you know, if he makes a mistake, he makes a mistake, he's subject to the criminal laws just like anybody else? You don't think he's in a special, a peculiarly precarious position?
I guess more worried about, you seem to be worried about the president being chilled. I think that we would have a really significant opposite problem if the president wasn't chilled. If someone with those kinds of powers, the most powerful person in the world, with the greatest amount of authority, could go into office knowing that there would be no potential penalty for committing crimes, I'm trying to understand what the disincentive is from turning the Oval Office into, the seat of criminal activity in this country.
After the oral arguments, the only thing that seems apparent is that Trump's trial for election interference is unlikely to take place before the election, and that delay is certainly a win for Trump. Joining me is constitutional law professor Michael Dorf of Cornell Law School. Mike, these oral arguments seem to be all over the place. What was your general impression?
So I was surprised that I was surprised. and what I mean by that is I have long regarded Trump's arguments here as pretty insubstantial. And therefore, I was surprised at how seriously the court was taking it. But I should be surprised at my surprise because they set the case for briefing and full oral argument a while back. That means that at least four justices thought that there was enough here to warrant plenary consideration rather than simply disposing of it in the way that Jack Smith had asked them to. Having said that, I'll add that I was at least a little bit pleased that nobody seemed especially taken by what I regard as the weakest of Trump's argument, which is this notion that the impeachment clause requires, as a precondition for prosecuting a former president, that that former president have been impeached and removed. And in fact, Justice Barrett, who was the only one who really asked any questions about that, asked the very obvious question, if that's what it means, why doesn't it mean that with respect to all other officers who are subject to impeachment, including Supreme Court justices? Many of the people who have been subject to impeachment have actually been prosecuted without being impeached beforehand. And so it's hard to see why the impeachment clause would mean that with respect to the president. And the lawyer for former President Trump gave a contradictory answer to that. First, he said that, well, this is just what the plain meaning of the clause is, but if that were the plain meaning, it would be plain with respect to people other than the president as well, and yet he had to concede that Justice Barrett was right about that. So then he said, well, and this is what Robert Bork thought when he was working in the Justice Department many years ago. So I thought that was not a great answer, and I was pleased that the court didn't credit this argument based on the impeachment clause, but that was about all that pleased me, because there were so many other, in my view, very implausible claims that were given serious credence. So you had Justice Gorsuch and Justice Alito and Justice Thomas asking questions based on hypothetical examples involving, you know, a corrupt Justice Department in the future, about planning a coup overseas, which was something that interested Justice Thomas, about all sorts of things that are, you know, potentially troubling if they were to arise, and ignoring the real thing that just happened.
It struck me as well, because several of the justices, and I think Alito, Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch, said, you know, I'm not really concerned about the facts here.
Right.
We're concerned about hampering the power of future presidents. Justice Gorsuch said, we're writing an opinion here for the ages.
Yes, and that is a fair point in general, right? In any particular case, the Supreme Court isn't merely resolving the case. It's also making law that will apply in future cases. But one would think if ever there's an occasion to focus especially on the particular fact before you, it's here where we have an unprecedented set of actions, at this point officially only alleged with respect to the criminal justice system, but unprecedented actions by a sitting president to attempt an overthrow of an election. You know, so I guess it's a little bit like saying, well, you don't want to use the fire extinguisher on a grease fire in your kitchen because, you know, it could damage the wall. Yeah, it could damage the wall, but if you don't use it now, the whole house is going to go up on fire.
Something that struck me, Justice Alito in particular seemed to be buying into Trump's argument, that one that he's been making outside courthouses over and over again. And he said the real threat to democracy was if an incumbent who loses a closely contested election knows that there's a possibility that if he leaves office, the president who's in his place is going to go after him. That president may be criminally prosecuted by a bitter political opponent. Will that not lead us into a cycle that destabilizes the functioning of our country as a democracy?
Right. Again, it's like worrying about in the future, maybe extraterrestrials will come and do bad things to us while there's a war on the ground now, which we're fighting an actual enemy. So again, right, there's nothing wrong with thinking about the long-term implications of your decision, but the focus on these remote hypotheticals at the expense of the very substantial damage in the here and now is, I guess the most polite way I could say it, is misguided.
Very polite. So did all or most of the justices reject or express skepticism about Trump's sweeping claims of absolute presidential immunity?
I think that's right, with the possible exception of Justice Thomas. It's not that Justice Thomas accepted it, but he didn't really say anything about it. He seemed interested in other things. I guess he wanted to focus on the difference between personal and official actions, and there, that was part of the theory of Trump's lawyer, Mr. Sauer, anyway. So, you know, it's hard to say. I think that there was something misleading about the argument if you weren't paying close attention. That is, you know, accepting the framing of, well, we need to distinguish between actions that are in an official capacity versus those that are in a personal capacity could be consistent with the extreme version of Trump's theory. Because, of course, even the extreme version says, well, you know, for prosecuting the president for a murder he committed while president, but as part of a love triangle, then that would be permissible. Although, as I heard Sauer say, well, it would be impermissible if he did it by having someone in the FBI do it for him, because giving orders to the FBI is an official function.
Well, Sauer also wouldn't give a yes or no to whether or not the president orders a coup. He wouldn't admit that that was necessarily private.
Yeah, although he's sort of admitted that in the D.C. Circuit. And I think Justice Kagan was exactly right when she characterized him as saying, well, yeah, but I don't want to say it because it sounds bad.
So do you think that it will come down to the distinction between private acts versus official? I mean, a lot of the justices, you mentioned Justice Kagan, and Justice Amy Coney Barrett read from the indictment and asked Michael Dreeben, who was representing the special counsel, well, is this public or is it private? I mean, do you think it would come down to that?
So I think that's probably the most likely way to get to 5 votes. I suspect that if there is a 5-justice majority for a version of that question that still permits the case to go forward substantially, the 5 main votes are the 3 Democratic appointees, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Barrett. It's possible they would pick up Justice Gorsuch on that, but maybe not. But in a way, none of that really matters. I thought that of the Republican appointees, Justice Barrett was the one who seemed to be taking the prosecution the most seriously, right? Because she wanted to know whether there would be a way to articulate some test that gives some kind of immunity for some core of official acts, but still have the case move forward quickly. I think that's a nice wish. You know, if that's what she's sincerely trying to do, I admire her for doing so. But I think that basically the court, you know, put the kibosh on this prosecution when they set it for oral argument, right? We're not going to get an opinion until June, probably not until late June. You know, you're not going to get jury selection immediately, right? The earliest you get a trial under the best of circumstances is October, and that's just not going to happen. The judge is not going to schedule a trial for the month before the presidential election. So it almost doesn't matter unless, right, Trump loses the election, doesn't somehow become president anyway, which is not a guarantee, and then the case goes forward during the second Biden administration.
Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, I'll continue this conversation with Professor Michael Dorff of Cornell Law School. We'll explore some of the other possible outcomes in the case. I'm June Gross, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Donald Trump says he has presidential immunity from prosecution in the election interference case brought by special counsel Jack Smith. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments today over that claim, although you heard very little in the more than 2.5 hours of questioning about Trump's actions. Several of the conservative justices, like Neil Gorsuch, said they didn't care much about the facts of this case.
And I'm not concerned about this case so much as future ones, too.
Yes. He was the president. He is the commander-in-chief. He talks to his generals all the time. And he told the generals, I don't feel like leaving office. I want to stage a coup. Is that immune?
If it
it's an official act, it's impeached.
Is it an official act?
On the way you've described that hypothetical, it could well be. I just don't know. You'd have to, again, it's a fact-specific, context-specific determination.
That answer sounds to me as though it's like, yeah, under my test, it's an official act, but that sure sounds bad, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly sounds very bad.
I've been talking to an expert in constitutional law, Michael Dorff, a professor at Cornell Law School. The Chief Justice said that he had concerns about the D.C. Circuit Court's opinion, and he suggested sending it back to rule on the extent to which official acts are protected. A couple of the other justices, I think, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, talked about sending it back. Do you think that under any version, this is going back to a lower court?
Oh, I think that's the most likely outcome. Again, Justice Barrett was exploring ways with Mr. Dreeben about how they might do that in a way that moves it forward with some alacrity, but I don't think there's a fifth vote for that. I think there would be four votes for that potentially. Basically the four women on the court. But I think that, you know, Roberts and certainly all of the justices to his right would want a test that would take some sorting out, and that just adds, you know, additional delay during the pretrial proceedings.
Besides the distinction between official acts and private acts, is there any other way you see them handling this?
Well, I see other obstacles. I mean, there were various points during the oral argument where some of the justices suggested that the former president can't be prosecuted under any statute that doesn't specifically list the president, right? So that if a statute says anybody who commits murder, you know, shall be subject to prosecution, that doesn't include the president because it said anybody, but, you know, the president isn't anybody, he's the president. So, you know, I don't think there are five votes for saying that, but I think someone might be attracted to that. Justice Thomas, at one point early in the argument, suggested that the very existence of a special prosecutor might be unconstitutional. Justice Kavanaugh had, you know, that bizarre couple of minutes when he's just sort of giving a dramatic reading of Justice Scalia's dissent from Morrison against Olson, which also was critical of the independent counsel. So there, you know, there's a whole lot of sort of dirt that was kind of just kicked up. And I think it's unlikely that many of those things ends up commanding a majority, but it will likely delay the release of the opinion till the very last day of the term. And then whatever additional procedure is called for is going to add further delay. So again, I'm less focused on the exact outcome than I am on the delay, because I don't think there are five votes, or may not even be one vote, for saying that the president is simply absolutely immune. But I do think there are at least five votes for some kind of a test that further delays trial and means it doesn't happen until after the election, if at all.
If the latter happens, do you think they would just send it back to the D.C. Circuit, or we would have, you know, the majority opinion, concurrences, dissents? Do you think that there would be some statement of what they think presidential immunity is?
Oh, yeah, I think it's likely that you'll get, you know, a variety of opinions. They put it on the calendar. And, you know, they could have put it off till next year, which would have been the end of the case. They didn't do that, but I don't think they realistically could have done that. So I don't think they're going to speed up the process between now and the end of June. And, you know, that cases that are argued in late April sometimes produce multiple concurrences, dissents, and so forth.
Obviously, they don't feel a rush at moving this forward.
Right, which is remarkable to my mind.
Do you think the liberal justices were able to sort of move the ball forward at all with their questions?
I don't think so, right? I mean, I would characterize most of the questions from Justices Sotomayor and Kagan as having as the subtext, oh, come on, right? Like, you know, we know what's going on here. This is outrageous. You're saying that Donald Trump is above the law. Whereas I thought Justice Jackson was trying to engage a bit more with the particulars of the argument and what's official, what is it, this, that, right? And I can see the case for doing either of those things. I don't think either move was very successful in terms of persuading any of their colleagues.
What did you think about Trump's attorney deciding not to do a rebuttal? Apparently there were gasps in the courtroom. I mean, like, drop the mic moment. I don't know what he was thinking.
So it's highly unusual in the U.S. Supreme Court. It's not at all unusual in the lower federal courts or in state courts that, you know, if you think you don't have a, you know, an important point you want to rebut with respect to, you drop your rebuttal. I mean, the thinking is sometimes like, you know, well, I'm ahead. I don't want to risk it. Like, maybe if I stand up there, Justice Kagan's going to ask me a tough question that I have a hard time answering. So I'll just, you know, I'm happy to hold my cards and, you know, and let it ride.
Broadly, you know, there's this case. There's the case over the January 6th obstruction charge. There's the Colorado ballot case. This Supreme Court seems to be, in various ways, inserting itself into the presidential election, unlike anything we've seen since Bush v. Gore. And it's at a time when the Supreme Court is not viewed favorably by a majority of the country. So, I mean, I'm wondering, do they think about that?
So I guess I would distinguish some of the cases. So I think that, although I think they got it wrong in the Colorado case, I think it would have been irresponsible to have left the 14th Amendment Section 3 question just to each of the 50 states and local election boards and so forth. I think what they should have done was take the case and agree with the Colorado Supreme Court. But you did sort of need a national determination with respect to whether Trump committed insurrection within the meaning of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. With respect to this case, I do think that what they've done does, at the very least, unnecessarily and, you know, dispositively delay any kind of a prosecution. As far as, you know, public opinion, I think it hasn't been true since the appointment of Justice Coney Barrett that the court really cares about that. I mean, I think that's something that Chief Justice Roberts has long cared about. I think he now realizes that he's lost that battle. And even if he still wants to fight for the court's standing, he's going to lose. And so they're just going to do what they think is the right thing to do. And, you know, I suspect that they think they're just following the law. Even Justice Alito, I believe, believes he is just following the law.
Anything else strike you about these arguments?
Yeah, so I thought there was just, as a Supreme Court watcher, there was one point relatively early in the argument that something somewhat remarkable happened, which was Justice Sotomayor asked a follow-up question to a question that Justice Alito had asked. And in the course of her question, she sort of pointed out something that she thought was mistaken or mysterious about Justice Alito's question.
Ah, I remember.
And then he took the opportunity to respond. And so it was one of those sort of, you know, almost breaking the fourth wall moments where instead of just pretending that they're just asking questions of the lawyers, they are actually arguing with each other on the bench. And I kind of liked it. I found it, you know, refreshingly honest.
Yes, Supreme Court oral arguments are something unto themselves. Thanks so much for sharing your insights, Mike. That's Professor Michael Dorf of Cornell Law School. Coming up next on the Bloomberg Law Show, as the Supreme Court oral arguments were going on, Donald Trump was in a courtroom in Manhattan, where a former friend of his, David Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer, was testifying against him. We'll do a deep dive into how the trial has been going.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
Former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker was back on the stand in Donald Trump's hush money trial today. He told the New York jury that he promoted Donald Trump and shielded him from unflattering stories long before the 2016 presidential campaign. Joining me to talk about the trial is former federal prosecutor Jeff Tsai. Jeff, I want to start at the very beginning with the charges here and what the prosecution has to prove.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at QuickBooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Falsifying a business record is a misdemeanor in New York. How are the prosecutors going to make that into a felony? What do they have to prove to do that?
They have to use an underlying felony charge in order to make this a felony. And so what they're using are the intent to commit another crime, in this case, election interference, which itself can be criminal under New York law. And I'll tell you something. To me, that is an often discussed but I think least analyzed part of this entire case. And the reason is because there is a statute of limitations problem that the government has were it to only charge this as a misdemeanor. You've also got an underlying policy issue at play where the government, in this case the DA's office, isn't necessarily interested in only charging this as a misdemeanor. But what happens if you have a jury that is implored by the defense lawyers to consider this as what's been called and what is often called a lesser included offense type of charge? So if the defense starts to feel like we're talking about a conviction scenario, they're going to want to talk to the jury about possibly looking at this as a, again, lesser included offense, where they're asking the jury to convict only for a misdemeanor charge, which is lesser than a felony.
The defense in the openings said, what on earth is a crime? The 34 counts are really just 34 pieces of paper. Is that an attempt to try to sort of lower the bar here?
Yes. It's also more substantively an attempt to try to turn a three-dimensional case into a one-dimensional or two-dimensional case. This is always going to be a pitched battle between an issue of paper or an issue of substance. And you see it in every kind of fraud case that exists. In this case, obviously dealing with a former president is no different. The defense's job front and center is going to be presenting to the jury the idea that at most this is a small c crime of paper. It is about moving things from the left side of the desk to the right side. And jury, do you want to be the ones who potentially take someone's liberty away because he didn't move the paper on the desk quite the right way? That's part of the reason why you saw the government in their opening statement start not just with the idea that we're talking about 34 felony charges, but that we're talking writ large, like take a step back, about election interference. And then you also heard that phrase in the opening statement where the prosecutor talks about the idea of the former president lying, quote, over and over and over again. They're just words, of course, that the prosecutor is saying, but there is a message behind it, which is this isn't just about paper. This is also about the core things that no one likes, lying and lying about something that matters.
And the prosecution in the opening said it's about a criminal conspiracy and a cover-up. He's not charged with conspiracy.
Interesting,
right? Is the prosecution setting the bar too high for itself?
I'll tell you, being a prosecutor and bringing cases, especially big ones like this, are complicated because there is a mission creep desire sometimes unintentional, by the way, to try to make the case too big. And often the approach that prosecutors try to take and frankly need to take in many instances is to try to avoid the mission creep and keep the cases as tight and small as possible. Not small in terms of substance, but small in terms of what you're asking a juror to put in her brain. Over the course of 6 weeks, there is going to be an extraordinary amount of information, testimony, documents, pictures. And I don't care how many notes a juror takes, it is difficult to keep all of that package together cleanly. And I don't care how great the closing argument is, it's difficult to do. So the bigger a case becomes, it creates it can create lots of variables. And variables are ultimately the enemy for a prosecutor when she's bringing her case or when he's bringing his case.
So there is then the Michael Cohen problem, which I'll call the Michael Cohen problem. And he's going to be the star witness for the prosecution. The defense said he was obsessed with President Trump. He was disbarred. He's a convicted felon and a convicted perjurer. He made a decision after getting caught in 2018 to blame Trump for virtually all his problems. How difficult is it for the prosecution to make Michael Cohen into a believable witness that they're going to hang their case on?
So, you know, to the point about trying to make a case too big, I think that principle applies, especially in a circumstance where you do have what I think you accurately described as the star witness, which is not turning Michael Cohen into an angel, but also not trying to otherwise characterize him as a devil. The reality is Michael Cohen is a person who clearly made mistakes. We know this because he pleaded guilty to felony offenses. If the government attempts to try to do too much, which is to say, try to turn Michael Cohen into this kind of angelic figure, one who's almost a martyr of sorts, it can backfire because there is a certain degree to which when a jury is listening and hearing and watching evidence, they're paying attention to that very basic normal person emotion, which is, do I just trust the information this person is giving me? So there is something to be said for trying to present a witness, especially a flawed one. And frankly, most witnesses and people are flawed, presenting the information in such a way that says this is a person who made mistakes. This is a person who is coming clean right now. And there is no reason for this person now to tell you anything but the truth. And I think that that's going to be really the job that the prosecutor has to undertake.
The prosecution has called David Pecker, the former publisher of the National Enquirer, as the first witness. Explain why the prosecution is calling him first.
The first witness is probably the most important evidentiary step that the government makes because it is literally the very first human being who will start presenting what is actually evidence to a jury. There is a tendency in a case like this that you put the star witness on the stand because it allows for two things. One, for the evidence to come in immediately for the jury, no waiting around. But also, number two, it allows the government to buffer in some other kinds of evidence in case the star evidence doesn't come in quite as they expected. This is slightly different. It's slightly different for a couple of reasons, one of which is an important goal that the government has is to try to get corroboration in place and to try to make sure that they are not relying only on Michael Cohen's testimony. And so you have someone in the form of David Pecker who serves as a narrator of sorts, who can tell the story not in the beginning of time, but in a very important snippet of time that will allow the government to both go forwards in time and backwards in time. And that's where they then slot in Michael Cohen. I think there is a very good chance that we will see Michael Cohen come in, if not as the second witness, then after potentially a witness like Clifford or McDougal or maybe even another person from the National Enquirer, both to bolster David Pecker's testimony and, again, to corroborate a lot of it, but to also then prepare for what will ultimately be a very rocky series of days when Michael Cohen then testifies.
And they have asked Pecker a lot about Michael Cohen's role, and it's come out already that Trump was the one who set up Cohen as the point man.
And I got to tell you, that was not only intentional on the government's part, I think it was an important piece of what they're trying to build in their case, which is not just this notion of we want to corroborate Michael Cohen and bolster this idea that he was an important person. They also want to directly insert Donald Trump into this conversation through someone other than Michael Cohen. That's an important piece because the testimony that the jury hears from Michael Cohen is going to rely in significant part on whether the jury trusts the conversations that Michael Cohen had with Donald Trump. And that's even putting aside the recording, assuming it gets into evidence. You've got the jury having to listen to Michael Cohen's testimony, and the only thing better than having just Michael Cohen describe a conversation is to have an entirely different person say that the conversation also happened. And that's why I think you see a lot of the descriptions from David Pecker about the conversations Donald Trump was in. And I think it's going to be something that the government continues to utilize for the rest of their case.
So, interestingly, David Pecker is one of the few witnesses that Donald Trump has not attacked in the media, at least as far as I know. And, you know, he's painting himself as a former friend of the president, loosely defining that word. How does the defense cross-examine him?
Oh, it's such an interesting play that we're going to see in the next couple of days when cross-examination starts. There is, of course, going to be some degree to which they serve to undermine David Pecker's credibility. I don't think it's simply this kind of Manichean battle between someone is good versus someone is evil. I think that they're going to try to take the approach with David Pecker. You've got your credibility issues, and we want to explore some of those with you and with the jury. But I think that they stop there because they don't need to go further in trying to address some of the credibility issues by necessarily tearing him down because of, I think, a second goal that they have, which is there are several things that they want from David Pecker, which serves to, for purposes of their defense, create the idea that ultimately what was happening in these facts were the kinds of things that happened in the seedy world of certain kinds of papers like the National Enquirer and things of the sort, and describe that to the jury as you don't have to like any of this. You don't have to like tabloid journalism, but this is how tabloid journalism works. That doesn't make it illegal. It certainly doesn't make it something fodder for an election of a national scale. So there are going to be things that they're going to want to pull from David Pecker that in some ways will rely on him having a certain degree of credibility. So they'll both want to attack it and then preserve it in some ways to be able to get some of the points that they want.
Interesting. Tricky.
Very tricky.
Thanks so much, Jeff. You gave us such terrific insight into the concerns of the prosecution and the defense. That's former federal prosecutor Jeff Tsai. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.